carrefour des arts. Une émission de la rédaction de Canal Académie. On retrouve Christa Leuc.
Symbolisme. The fundamental ideas, the second half of the 19th century, witnessed the birth of the artistic movement we call symbolism, which was to end during the First World War. And this program on Canal Académie is devoted to the subject. Once again, we have the great pleasure of receiving Michael Francis Gibson, art historian and critic, writer and international journalist. Michael Francis Gibson, hello.
Hello, Christa Leuc.
You've been writing essays on art over the past 30 years and for various publications, including the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. You also published several books on art, including monographs on Bruegel, Gauguin, Duchamp and Alexandre Calder. And you already gave us your learned insight through a thoroughly detailed story of The Way to Calvary, Bruegel's famous painting at the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna, in a program that, by the way, our listeners very much appreciated. The book we plan to discuss today is devoted to symbolism. It was published in several languages by Taschen, including French, English and German. And maybe Japanese?
Maybe Japanese, yes.
Wonderful. And this precious publication, which may be described as a coffee table book, presents symbolist art and the state of mind illustrated by artists of repute in most countries of Europe. And we might mention, for instance, in France, Gustave Moreau, Maurice Denis, Puvis de Chavannes, and Odillon Redon. In Belgium, Fernand Knopf and Félicien Rops. And they include such figures as the Swiss artists Arnold Böcklin and Ferdinand Hodler, the Germans Franz von Stück and Max Klinger, the British Dante Gabriel Rossetti and Aubrey Beardsley, and finally, last not least, the famous Gustav Klimt, Austrian of course, the Czech Alphonse Mucha, and the Polish painter Stanislaw Wispianski, or the Russian Mikhail Vrubel. And consulting your marvelous book, one can learn that a number of them appear to have sunk into obscurity or discredit after the war. And interest in them only revived some 50 years later in the 70s. How do you account for this sort of fluctuation?
Well, your question prompts me to make an observation and to ask a question myself. The observation is the following. The symbol has always and everywhere been present in art, its first beginning in prehistory. So here's the question. Why did one feel the need at that particular point in history to give an artistic movement the name symbolism?
Yes, and what's the answer?
Well, I'm tempted to say that the symbol itself had become a problem at that time, and that society as a whole was entering into a great crisis of the symbol from which we have not yet emerged.
And what brought on this crisis?
Well, I'd say it's partly the consequence of the Great Upheaval. The Great Upheaval is the title of a painting by the Belgian painter Henri de Groux, Le Grand Chambardement, painted in 1893, which is something of a sketch in oil, really, and which shows an entire society taking leave of a familiar and beloved terrain and taking the road to exile. It's a melancholy group of people and a melancholy observation of the spirit of symbolism. The immigrants can be seen passing beside an enclosure which has been thrown down. A broken crucifix is there, surrounded by fallen statues. For me, the enclosure designates the separate place of a transcendence which is rejected by the positivistic, triumphant positivistic spirit of the period. In other words, and roughly speaking, the philosophy which wanted to edify all knowledge on the sciences, on the hard sciences. Crucifix and statues symbolize not only Christianity, but in a more general way, they're a representation of a world which recognizes an interaction, continuous interaction, between several levels of reality, between the natural and the spiritual, or again, more in a wider sense, between the concrete and the imaginary. In reality, too, the second half of the 19th century was in the course of was experiencing an exodus which was quite unprecedented. The industrial development of France and the other European countries, not of England because they had a century in advance on the matter, had created a huge need for manpower, a need which emptied the countryside. In other words, for instance, on statistics show that one out of seven people who were born in the country between the years 1850 and 1930, only one remained. One went abroad to other countries or to the colonies, and five went into the cities.
So there were concrete statistics on this.
Oh yes, absolutely.
State.
And what basically what happens is that what the skeptical philosophy of the 18th century had failed to achieve, the rural exodus of the 19th century managed to do. The traditional faith, which had been maintained on a day-to-day basis by the customary fabric of the rural societies, was gradually eroded. Each one living in his village knew who he was and knew his place. His identity and his filiation were acknowledged, and he benefited from the degree of solidarity and support which resulted from that. Now, when he came to the city, he discovered himself without identity or filiation. The old solidarity no longer worked. Each one was simply a zero which was lost in the great mass of people. So society as a whole found itself totally repolarized in this situation, which was entirely new. And at the same time, the immigrant found himself disarmed in front of the excesses of the new industrial world, which was completely uncontrolled to the extent that it was something quite new. It was unfolding in a legal void. So it wasn't at all surprising that socialism should have arisen, particularly at that point, to not only call for justice and respect of the person, but also to elaborate a new form of solidarity in the new situation.
Yeah, so it was a total change of society.
Yes, absolutely, yes. As I said a moment ago, the whole of society was in a crisis of the symbol. And this is a crisis from which we haven't yet emerged. So we are, in fact, all the more involved in it still that we haven't really measured the scope of the problem. We can always quote the symbolist poet Jules Lafargue when he expresses his nostalgia for infinity and at the same time his radical skepticism. We have a few verses here which he says, "Where did you come from, infinity? Why are proud senses so mad to look beyond the allocated keyboards? Why do they trust in mirrors more pleasing than the word and kill themselves? Come on, infinity, show us your papers."
Incredible sentence, really.
Yes.
If you think about it, how can one imagine a sentence like, or an idea like infinity?
Show us your papers. Yes, well, that's the... What is your legitimacy in infinity? And that is, of course, one of the problems. We're now beginning to realize that this search for infinity, for transcendence, if you like, is an indispensable aspect of the human condition, which is simultaneously rooted in the biological and in the dream. So you might say that symbolism reveals a crisis of mentalities. I have in mind what the French medieval historian Georges Duby called precisely the mentalities. He presented them as systems of images, systems of in motion, and consequently objects suitable for study by historians, which, while people may not be aware of it, command their behavior and their conduct. That's the way he conceives mentalities, and that's basically what we mean when we speak of a culture. We follow a set of rules which have been given to us and a set of representations which seem obvious to us. So the new industrial world, which was guided by the spirit of positivism, which believes only in fact, imposed its mark on the mentalities, maintaining that scientific spirit would inevitably replace theological and metaphysical thought. So in this perspective, and in the measure that we can, no immaterial or imaginary order is acknowledged, the symbol, which refers to these things, had no reason to exist anymore. And as the French symbolist poet Gustave Kahn complained, it's all too clear that these people are only interested in discovering resources and that the wellspring of dreams has run dry.
In the city, for instance. I mean, in this new era of industrialism, yeah. Hmm.
And so, to give a concrete example of the situation, when I could tell you about the reception which was given a painting by Gauguin, who at the beginning of his career, his artistic career, had been working with Camille Pissarro outside Pontoise. He'd started painting in the manner of Pissarro, in an impressionist vein.
They were friends also, no?
They were friends, yes, of course. They became very friendly. And then Gauguin went to Brittany, and he encountered various people, including Émile Bernard, who led him to change his style totally. And one of his paintings, which date from 1888, Jacob's Struggle with the Angel, provoked the great reprobation of Pissarro, who had convinced anarchist and a militant secularist. So
why? Why?
Well, in this painting, you see a group of Breton women with their special headdress rounding a scene in which a man is struggling with an angel. He's struggling in the middle of a field which is painted uniformly bright red and with a dark tree cutting it diagonally across it. So, according to Pissarro, Gauguin had given way to the desire for lucre, for money, by trying to seduce the bourgeois collectors, and therefore he had he had betrayed his principles. Well, Pissarro could only be discontented by this, not only by the style, but also by the subject, because in his view, the only possible subject was reality itself, since there is nothing else. And Gauguin's style and his subject matter were betrayal.
In Pissarro's eyes, yes.
In Pissarro's eyes. But one can also imagine, and that's what we do, that Gauguin was evoking his own moral dilemma, his struggle with himself, with his need to paint, which had obliged him to abandon his wife and children and go off to fulfill what he considered his destiny. So the painting gives a dramatic form to an event of the soul, something inward rather than of nature.
Yeah, so the symbolist mentality or the movement was in the air, but how did symbolism acquire its name?
Well, you know, it's like a baby is born and then only a few days later he is christened. So what happened was that, I mean, you see symbolist paintings dating from the 50s and 60s, the late 50s and 60s, the 1850s and 1860s. And then in 1886, on the 18th of September, the writer Jean Moreas, whose real name was Yanis Papadiamantopoulos, wrote in the literary supplement of Le Figaro an article devoted to what he called the decadent poets. And these poets, he said, deserved rather to be called symbolists. And then he defined symbolic poetry, he says. Symbolic poetry sought to clothe the idea with a tangible form which would not be its own purpose, but would serve to express the idea while remaining subordinate to it.
So you have to think about
it. I may even repeat it. Symbolic poetry sought to clothe the idea with a tangible form which would not be its own purpose, but would serve to express the idea while remaining subordinate to it. In other words, symbolic poetry refers to a mental representation, a great cultural representation of some kind, which is illustrated in a perceptible form.
How would you say
surnatural? Well, the supernatural. It could be the supernatural, yes, I suppose you could call it that.
Well, now that we know more about the way the symbolist movement came into existence, I suggest, Michael Gibson, we make a short break. We are still with Michael Francis Gibson, talking about symbolism, one of his major books published by Taschen. And we would like to know now, how would you characterize symbolist art?
Well, take Puvis de Chavannes, for instance. He was a forerunner of the symbolist movement. And some of his paintings, which can be seen in the Sorbonne, for instance, they may strike us as slightly insipid in colour and form, and even in the expression of some of the characters he depicts. There was, however, an originality in his formal organisation and his use of colour. He organised space in an original way, rather flat, to the extent that a humorous illustrator once did a drawing showing a historic figure touching the horizon with his sword, to sort of satirize Puvis de Chavannes' painting, and his areas of color were more or less uniform, which was a great simplification. So he may be considered a symbolist to the extent that he does not attempt to give a naturalist or illusionistic representation of
reproduction of the nature.
World.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
So we discover Épuvis de Chavannes at the avant-garde of the symbolism.
Well, yes, it's of course the trouble with the avant-garde is that it becomes an arrière-garde eventually. But yes, this sort of thing initiated a trend towards abstraction that would develop through the work and ideas of a number of other artists, and which finds its first expression in the its first theoretical expression in the words in a sentence by Maurice Denis, who says that every painting is a flat surface covered with colors assembled in a certain order. It's a very simplifying concept, but it implies
yes, it, is.
it implies something that is essential to 19th and 20th century, late 19th and early 20th century painting. Now, this conception had come to Maurice Denis through his friend Paul Serruzier, who'd got it from Gauguin, who had received it in turn from the young Émile Bernard, who had come to Pont-Aven, where Gauguin was painting, and suggested that when he painted a landscape, he should use the most vivid colors he could. So symbolism conceived in this way opens the way to abstraction.
Well, actually, the principal pioneers of abstraction, like the Russians Kandinsky and Malevich, or the Czech Kupka, or the Dutchman even Mondrian, had all been symbolist painters at the outset, hadn't they?
Well, yes, that's right. Symbolism tends to include all the artists who, in their way of painting, distance themselves from the so-called realist representation of the world. But one also integrates into the movement, rightly or wrongly, painters whose style is really rather academic, but who are nonetheless symbolists in their idealism, their occult interests, and their choice of subjects. That's the case of the Belgians like Jean Delville and Léon Frédéric, for instance.
Yeah, well, let me say that all this is a bit confusing, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so, yes. We actually find a certain number of circles that more or less overlap. A whole area of this trend is coloured with religiosity, sometimes with a Catholic dominant note and sometimes syncretic or esoteric. But you also find inside symbolism a mystique of art for art, like that illustrated by James McNeill Whistler or Stéphane Mallarmé, the French poet. So the most striking aspect of symbolist art, what distinguishes these artists from the great religious artists of the earlier periods, is their solitude, their isolation inside their imaginary world, their dreamy solitude, which reminds one somewhat of a person who is on a desert island and who is telling himself stories to himself alone. Or in the words of one can quote the Polish poet Mieczysław Jastrun, who says, you can't build a church with a single brick. You can't build a community, in other words, with a single brick.
Well, aren't these two notions, the idea of building a church or a community, as you just said, and that of favoring a withdrawal into an imaginary world, a bit contradictory? Does this contradiction have any bearing upon what you said a moment ago about a crisis of the symbol?
Well, yes, I suppose so, yes. This is a point where anthropologists can be very helpful. Anthropologists have shown, after a full century of work, starting at the beginning of the 20th century, that no society can continue to exist in the absence of an imaginary construction, in the absence of a common, shared, symbolic landscape, if you wish, which defines the identity of each one of the members and gives them a symbolic representation of their origins and their destination. Now, on this point, Lévi-Strauss, in his book Triste Tropique, I don't know what the English title for that is, but it relates his journeys to Brazil, and he tells a story of a Jesuit mission which went to an Amazon village and took the people out of their circular villages and put them into a village built according to Spanish plan, which was orthogonal. And the strange thing happened is that all these people fell sick and died. And Lévi-Strauss believes that what this means is basically that the Indians in their circular villages considered this a sort of model of the universe, of the cosmos. They felt at home in it because it told them where they were and it described their surrounding world and integrated them into it. The village built by the Jesuits no longer gave them any idea of who they were. So they simply died away.
Yeah, they lost completely their...
Their identity, their
yes.
sense of their of belonging, mm. their sense of identity. In fact, it confirms the words of the Georgian philosopher that somebody told me about, Merab Mamardashvili, who says, man is a symbolic institution.
And how do you account for the European crisis of the 19th century?
Well, I think it was all at once political, religious, and sociological. The scientist ideology of the 19th century, and by scientist it means a sort of vulgar perception or vulgar belief that science is capable of explaining everything, in other words, of giving us guidance in life, which is not the case. It's not the case, but for the good reason that Pascal already pointed out, that science can tell us what is, what exists, but it cannot tell us what is worthwhile. The scientist ideology of the 19th century encouraged scorn for both symbol and past, and hence for the past generations. This leads to the rejection of one's fathers, which in itself is already a symbolic act. And it signifies symbolically that we ourselves are come out of nothing. So imagine, think about the radical tabula rasa of the Soviets, who reflected exactly this mentality and who proclaimed that they were going to create a new man, and then see what happened, for instance, in Cambodia with the Khmer, the Khmer Rouge.
Among other examples,
yes.
So, and what conclusion do you draw from this?
Well, basically that man is indeed a symbolic institution, which suggests that all symbolic system is a construction of the collective imagination, inside which each individual imagination finds its niche. Now, the problem of the symbolist period is precisely that. Its collective imagination was beginning to fall apart. Its collective imagination was falling apart under the assault of science and social change, and it could no longer fulfill its indispensable role. So the poets, the so-called decadent poets and the symbolist artists, resisted this movement. They expressed the disarray of a public harassed by positivism, according to the formula of the expression of the French novelist Joris Karl Huysmans. Everybody becomes aware at that point. Everybody at that point becomes aware. Let me start again. Everybody at that point becomes aware of a new solitude, a new spiritual solitude, resulting from the fact that we no longer live altogether in the same imaginary landscape.
Yes, can you say this again, please? What did Joris Karl...
The so-called decadent poets and the symbolist artists were resisting this movement. They were expressing a disarray which was characterized by the French novelist Joris Karl Huysmans as being the disarray of a public harassed by positivism. Everybody was aware of a new isolation, a new spiritual solitude, resulting from the fact that everybody was no longer living in the same imaginary landscape.
What exactly do you mean by a collective imagination?
Well, I could answer that by quoting Napoleon Bonaparte. During his campaign in Poland, he was staying with the Potocki family, actually. And one evening at dinner, he boasted that he held the French people in the hollow of his hand. And his hosts were apparently a bit shocked by this, so that he felt the need to explain. He said, "It's by the imagination that you lead people." I would add also that it's by the imagination that people, individuals construct, form themselves, shape themselves. This suggests much more than is actually apparent, particularly concerning political legitimacy, but also religious legitimacy, and even the intimate legitimacy of each individual, which finds its foundation in an imaginary structure. This is what one calls a culture. So Bonaparte had been able to mobilize the imagination of the French people, and thanks to that he had accomplished wonders. But this imagination of conquest and liberation was cut down by defeat. And the principle, however, remains true, what Bonaparte said. before him, consider Islam, the imaginary view, the imaginary world. Before this, with Islam, for instance, an imaginary structure imagined by Mohammed had receded. Bonaparte had mobilized the imagination of the French people, and thanks to that, he'd accomplished wonders. This imagination of conquest and liberation was cut down by defeat, but the principle expressed by Bonaparte remained true. And the same thing with Islam, which spread over the world like a wildfire. The Christian imagination, in the meanwhile, also had assembled and then divided Europe. So there's continuity in the action of the imagination all through history.
So maybe to understand the function of the imagination in these times.
So to understand the function of the imagination in those days, let's say, when we could imagine a man of the 18th century, his thoughts and his feelings when he is standing in front of a representation of the crucifixion or in front of a portrait of the emperor as he be a person who himself is either a believer or a loyal subject. In both cases, you can see that he is drawing the energy from the imaginary constructions which give him his own cohesion, his legitimacy, his authority in the European world. Now, the decomposition of this imaginary unit, this imaginary organization of this legitimacy. So in both cases, actually, he was renewing himself by communing with the imaginary constructions which gave the European world its cohesion, its legitimacy, and its authority. And the collapse of this imaginary world, of this legitimacy and authority, was completed by the revulsion that was aroused by the first total war of history. So in these conditions, the art of the symbolist period sought refuge, so often sought refuge, in a world of solitary dreamers, peopled by androgynous characters, monsters, ideal or evil women, and enigmatic situations.
So I suggest we make another short break before having a closer look to all these monsters and evil women. We are still with Michael Francis Gibson, the author of a wonderful volume called Symbolism, published by Taschen. And before our break, you mentioned the very strange figures who populate symbolist art. Can you mention some significant representations?
Well, yes, I could talk, for instance, tell you something about the Belgian Fernand Knopf, who painted women with rather strange faces and sometimes depressive gazes. And there was one painting of his which represents Oedipus and the Sphinx in a sort of game of seduction, yes. Or then the Frenchman Gustave Moreau, who created complex mythological scenes populated by androgynous figures. Or the German Max Klinger, who did a series of prints concerning the man who finds a woman's glove on a skating rink. And then the succession of prints show his fantasies about the subject, which ends, I think, with a point when the pterodactyl flies out of the window of the house, carrying off the glove, and you see his arms reaching through the broken window, trying to grasp the animal.
It's a fantastic view of things.
It's fantasy, yes, it's a strong fantasy. And then we have the Belgian Léon Spilliard, who did very mysterious, difficult to describe the actual, what gives it the aura of mystery, because you have a strange rounded staircase with very tall steps, and you have a female figure who seems to be running down these steps. It's hard to tell what is happening, but the mood is very strange always.
Supernatural.
Yes, eerie, I would say. But this is nothing compared to the painful, terrifying work of Alfred Kubin, the Austrian, who's evoked sexual terror of a man who was an adolescent, lived in great depression, and attempted to suicide on his mother's grave, Kubin did. Went there with a revolver and it didn't fire because it was rusty. That was what saved him. But the German writer Ernst Jünger, who saw the works of the first 10 years of the 20th century, said that the atmosphere was that. The German writer Ernst Jünger, who saw his work the first 10 years of the 20th century, was saying that the atmosphere in it was that of the periods that precede the great disasters. So In fact, Corbyn's work is still perceived as very strange, and I remember that an English critic writing about my book on symbolism declared that this artist had would have done better not to draw them.
These works, as you describe them, don't really seem to fit into the collective imagination of that period. And as you just evoked anecdote, some of them can appear disturbing even today.
Yes, but they have gradually managed to get to fuse into our collective imagination. And I think that historic experience, recent historic experience, has allowed us to discover their relevance. At the time, they were more attractive to solitary amateurs of art, more or less neurotic, according to Huysmans, who invented the character of Des Esseintes, who was in a novel called Against Nature, Là-bas in French, but Against Nature in English. And this man is rich and idle, and he's a sort of dandy. Huysmans modeled his character. Huysmans modeled his character, Des Esseintes, on a fashionable figure of the day, the Comte Robert de Montesquieu, who was a great dandy. And in his novel, this character winds up in a deep depression, and finally his doctor comes and takes him away from his villa to give him some sort of treatment.
This is a typical decadent image.
Yes, well, the Comte Robert de Montesquieu, in fact, is also a model of Proust's Baron de Charlus.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. So, unfortunately, as we reach the end of our program for today, can you try to draw a conclusion for us?
Well, yes, one might say that symbolism represents a totally paradoxical undertaking. Now, this is something that we can begin to understand today. It was an attempt to create a sort of community of those who had fallen by the wayside of progress. The arts come out, appear there as a sort of parallel universe where people like Des Esseintes or historic figures like King Ludwig of Bavaria seek refuge. And in the case of Ludwig, for instance, this was a man who had acknowledged the importance of Wagner, but whose wild castles had absolutely no function in reality. It was also, he was living in a dream. So you find in this form of art elements of neurosis and of madness, but also traces of certain specifically cultural factors, which are no longer private, in other words, which are no longer those of the individual psyche, and which were at work in the individual minds of these people, imaginary or real, of which I've been talking. It is a neurosis inherent to culture itself. So many symbolist arts were somewhat of an expression of the discomfort or the suffering of both the individuals and the collective society. And we're only beginning to decrypt, to decipher these things today, because we now have the distance necessary to perceive them correctly. But it is worthwhile noting that this form of art appears chiefly in the Catholic countries of industrial Europe.
Yes, well, the religious symbol was so important, of course.
Exactly. Yes. And Walter Benjamin, in fact, explains the apparition of the demonic, you see in the works of Alfred Kubin, for instance, as by saying that the concept of the demonic appears wherever modernity comes into conjunction with Catholicism.
Well, this surely calls for further comment. Michael Gibson, we shall meet soon for a second broadcast on this subject, and it will guide us through the enigmatic realm of the symbolists in various European countries, including France, Germany, England, Czechoslovakia, Poland, which was very important also for the symbolist movement, and Russia, Norway, and Austria, of course. We thank you now for the light you have thrown on the subject and for the very helpful ideas you have offered our listeners. And I remind them that your book, Symbolism by Michael Gibson, published by Taschen, is a 250-page book, abundantly illustrated with the more significant symbolist artists. And the cover shows Dante Gabriel Rossetti's Verticordi and the John Everett Millais' Ophelia, an oil painting dating from 1852. Surely one of the most famous symbolist paintings. Michael Gibson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kristen.